You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. What caused some of the great civilizations of the past to collapse? What can we learn from their fates? These are questions that Jared Diamond explores in his new book, Collapse: How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. He looks at the downfall of, among others, the Easter Islanders, the Mayans, Anasazi, and the Norse of Greenland. Diamond was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his previous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. That book looked at the buildup of civilizations. It examined the differing rates of buildup on different continents over the last 13,000 years and explained how and why Western civilizations developed the ability to dominate much of the world. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Jared Diamond's formal training was in laboratory biology, biochemistry, and physiology. He is today professor of geography and of environmental health sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Diamond is the recipient of many honors, including the National Medal of Science and a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. He's published more than 200 articles. He's the author of three previous books. His latest, Collapse: How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, is published by Viking. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The numbers to use if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon. Professor Diamond, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be back with you again today.
Yes. When you set out to write Guns, Germs, and Steel, did you have in mind this volume, Collapse?
No. When I set out to write Guns, Germs, and Steel, I had my hands full writing Guns, Germs, and Steel. But once the dust had settled on that book in 1998, and I asked myself, what's the most interesting and important stuff that I could write about? I thought back to my teenage years and my 20s when I was fascinated with the collapses of great civilizations that left abandoned cities in the jungles and deserts, and I realized that's really germane to the problems facing us today, so that's going to be my next book.
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned in my introduction, your formal training is in the sciences. When and how did your attention begin to turn to world history? You mentioned that interest of yours when you were a younger man in your 20s.
Actually, my attention started out in world history before it turned to science. I was born in 1937. I grew up in World War II, and as I was a child, my father had maps of the battlefields, and he moved the pins on the maps each day. So I grew up with world history in my face, and then I lived in Europe for 4 years in the 1950s, and there it was again in my face. I got my formal training in membrane physiology, and for quite some time I was the world's expert on the gallbladder. But history has always interested me, and finally in my mature years I've come back to my first interest.
Mm. At the outset of Collapse, you introduced us to two dairy farms, one contemporary, one ancient, and they both have strengths and weaknesses. The biggest difference, though, one is flourishing, the other abandoned hundreds of years ago. You want to tell us about those two farms?
Sure. One of those dairy farms is near where my wife and kids and I spend parts of our summers each year in Montana. It's a dairy farm. It's actually the most advanced high-tech dairy farm in southwestern Montana. And the other dairy farm is one that I visited in Greenland a couple of summers ago. We have Vikings from Norway established a colony that thrived during the Middle Ages. The dairy farm in Greenland actually belonged to the Bishop of Greenland, and it was almost the same size as the Montana dairy farm, and the owners of both farms were pious religious people, and both farms were at the cutting edge, the difference being that in Norse Greenland, everybody, including the bishop and the farmers, ended up dead, and the farm is abandoned, although the stone ruins are there, and you can count the number of cow stalls, and you can see the doors where they led the cows in and out, while the Montana dairy farm, of course, is still there. And so that posed for me the beginning of my book, the question, what's going to happen to the United States?
Hmm. What weaknesses does that contemporary farm in Montana share with the farm that was eventually abandoned many years ago?
Well, some of those weaknesses are weaknesses of society as a whole. Norse Greenland had problems which eventually did them in. The United States has well-known problems, and we'll see what happens with those. But the individual farms also were similar in their size and the religious nature of their owners, as I mentioned. But in addition, both were in somewhat marginal environments for dairying. Montana is rather far north, and so you can't grow hay as rapidly as you can in some other areas. Greenland, of course, is rather far north. And both farms were the leaders in their area. The dairy farm of my friends in Montana is the leading dairy farm. Its owner is the representative of the Montana Dairy Milk Cooperative. Just as the Bishop of Greenland was the head of Greenland as well as being owner of the farm. So those are the similarities in the two farms.
Yeah. Now, are your friends in Montana aware of the fragility of their environment?
Oh, they know the fragility of their environment much better than I do. Because they and their parents and their grandparents have been struggling to eke out a living there. And I remember, in fact, my dairy owner friends in Montana relating to me their life story and the story of their parents and grandparents, and telling me the words were roughly as this, that their parents clawed out a living penny by penny at a time when many other farmers were going under, but they eventually succeeded.
Yeah. This gets me thinking about a couple of things. How about how important awareness is? And it also gets at the idea of we have choices to make, which is part of the title of your book.
That's right. Awareness and choices are two of the central themes of my book. As for awareness, this was something that I discovered to my surprise once I got into the stories of how societies collapse. A question that my UCLA students asked me when I started teaching the material for courses is, why on earth does a society not see the problems if they're going to collapse eventually because of deforestation or climate change or overfishing? Surely they see this happening for decades or centuries before the problems blow up, and why don't they solve their problems? But one of the reasons, as you mentioned, is a question of awareness. Some problems are hard to see. For example, in Montana, one of the agricultural problems is salinization, salt being brought up by irrigation and other practices. But salt in the ground is something that you can't see. It's hard to be aware of salt until it's caked out on the surface. And then also, there are some things of which we just don't want to be aware.
Mm-hmm.
We turn our eyes to them because it may be against our short-term interest to acknowledge them.
Yeah. And we've got to go about the everyday business of living, and given that with how difficult it can be to tease out the problems and address them, you begin to maybe get just a glimmer of understanding about how somebody could cut down the last tree.
Yeah, often most of us are overwhelmed by short-term problems. What am I going to do today? Or in many parts of the world, where am I going to get my next meal? It also happens for politicians. I have a friend who happens to be Republican and closely connected to the present administration. And shortly after the elections of 2000 and 2001, when the new administration was installed, my friend went to Washington and met his friends there in the administration, came back, and he told me, boy, my friends there, they've got a 90-day perspective. That's to say, they're concerned only with those issues that are going to blow up into big crises within the next 90 days, and any more long-term issues, they're too overwhelmed and they don't have time for them. That's a standard human problem.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Jared Diamond, his latest book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or succeed. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on Line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. Could I bring up two items? They're kind of disparate, but I can't help it. A few hours ago in the morning program, the guest had written about the culture of Lucent Technologies, a spinoff from AT&T, and the problems arising from AT&T managers having to now take over a new company in an environment of rapid upstarts and fierce competitiveness after having lived under the environment of the AT&T world for so many years. And it sounds exactly like what you were describing when you bring up the questions of, if they are so good, why can't they foresee the things coming? And I bring that up as just a coincidence of what an interesting day it's been, if you can put those two things together. But the question of size struck me. Most people think of societies, cultures, things that fail, being on a very massive scale. And have you found that regardless of the scale of the unit you're looking at, you can make non-trivial comparisons, non-trivial similarities from the size of a single dairy farm to a single island in the vastness of the Pacific to I've forgotten what the largest, the Incas, I'm sorry, or the Mesoamericans. Does scale make that much of a difference in what causes failure, or is the human factor mostly what's going on?
Those are two very interesting questions. Let me take them in reverse order. Second, your question about scale. There are some things that apply to any scale. Problems of deforestation and water and soil erosion apply both to small societies and the largest societies. And, for example, it's very instructive what happened on Easter Island, a little island of 50 square miles out in the Pacific Ocean with 10,000 Polynesians. The problems that eventually did in those 10,000 Polynesians are similar to the problems that billions of people around the world face today. But you were also correct that scale makes a difference. Very big societies have complex interdependences, and so they are at risk. If one element fails, then it can precipitate widespread failures. And that's an issue in the world today where we have an enormous scale, where thanks to globalization, the scale is the whole world. So that's an interesting point. And on your first point, that you were jolted or surprised to hear the parallels with Lucent Technology a few hours ago, one of the interesting things that happened to me after the publication of my previous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, was that it got reviewed in Seattle by a guy called Bill Gates, who reads a lot of reviews books, and Bill Gates said that many of the things that Jared Diamond talks about is happening in history, he, Bill Gates, sees as happening in the business world. I hadn't realized that. I ended up getting introduced to Bill Gates and talking with him for a few hours, and he's a very thoughtful person. It's very interesting to explore those parallels between the business world of Lucent Technology and the world of history and the Maya kings.
Mm. The Easter Island episode, as I've seen it portrayed over and over again, again, Celeste's point about hindsight, seems to be a case, depending on how you look at it, of either runaway positive feedback, in which, faced with a stress, they do more and harder of what they've done already, which hasn't worked, until it collapses, and an old definition of insanity, to continue doing the same thing again and again, expecting different results. And it's hard now in terms of foresight to decide, are you being insane or are you being brave, persistent, and determined that you will succeed? Because a lot of the success stories always start with, he failed at this, he failed at that, he continued to fail until he succeeded miraculously. And those are selected examples. So is there any way you think, before a collapse, to measure whether people are behaving insanely or simply dogged, persistent, noble in the sense of they wouldn't give up. Thanks for the chance to talk.
Sure. Yes to those interesting points. And in fact, so much so that I wonder whether you read the advance proofs of my book, because those issues do come up in my book. It turns out that one of the hardest things for societies is when the core values of a society that have helped the society get through difficulties in the past, the values that have been the source of the society's greatest strength, now prove maladaptive and are getting the society in trouble. It's hard to turn away from what has been the source of your strength in the past. That happened to the Greenland Norse, who viewed themselves as a European Christian society and enabled them to preserve their sanity and to keep on going for 450 years on isolated Greenland, but eventually it did them in when they refused to learn from the Inuit. Or here in the United States, for a couple of centuries, George Washington in his farewell address warned us to beware of entangling alliances, and the United States has had a successful history of isolationism, which we could afford as long as the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans really shielded us from the rest of the world. Yes, we got involved in World War I, and then we became isolationist again. But nowadays, the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans are not shields. Our value of isolationism in the past no longer works, and it's going to be a painful rethinking for us to recognize that our interests are going to be preserved only if we get involved with dozens of desperate countries around the world and get involved on a long-term basis before they collapse and send us terrorists and we have to send in 100,000 troops each time.
Yeah, that's one of the points that came through so loud and clear to me in this book. And also, I couldn't help but think about the recent horrific disaster in Asia, the earthquake and resulting tsunami, and the efforts that are now underway to bring relief and to begin to rebuild. And I wonder if this could, and I've been thinking about this, but I don't know quite what the questions are to ask here. But maybe these efforts now could offer us a model or a way for tackling global environmental problems. Here we have this massive relief effort beginning. And I wonder if this could show us the way in the future to come together and to tackle big problems.
That's a good point. Yeah, the tsunami I see is a model in at least two different ways. And one of them, as you mentioned, it's a model of international help. But tsunamis aren't the only problem in other countries that call for help. Many countries are just crushed by burdens of public health problems, malaria, AIDS, other tropical diseases, or they're crushed by environmental or population problems. There are other areas where we can help. But the tsunami is also instructive because at first one thinks the tsunami had nothing to do with us. It was this earthquake on the seabed, and out came the tsunami waves, and humans had nothing to do with it, and we couldn't have prevented it. But then you stop and think. Low-lying tropical countries in that area used to have their coastlines protected by mangrove forests, and so a tsunami wouldn't get very far inland. And they used to be protected by coral reefs, so a tsunami would barely even hit the shore. But mangrove forests have been among the most rapidly depleted habitats in the world in the last few decades, and coral reefs were hammering away at a rate that many of the world's coral reefs will be gone in a few decades. So the fact that the tsunami caused such damage is in part due to humans having removed two of the main barriers against tsunamis. And then you also ask about global warming, climate change, and global warming. With global warming, sea level is expected to rise by something like 5 feet in the course of this century. And if you're 5 feet higher, that sure exposes your risk to tsunamis. So the tsunami makes the point that even natural disasters, our exposure to natural disasters, interacts strongly with what we ourselves have done to the environment.
Yeah. Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I've got one question. Well, actually, I could ask quite a few questions, but I'll limit it to one question, and then I'd like to see if I can elicit comments on two quotes from two different reviews of your book. My question is, I was just curious if I know that like the Santa Fe Institute has studied robustness and you know, how robust a system is, and somebody like L.H. Gunderson has written Understanding Transformations in Human and Natural Systems, Panarchy, and I was just curious if that's affected your thinking at all.
Yeah, to respond to that question, robustness, or its flip side, fragility, I identify as one of the two main variables why some societies collapse and others don't. If you look historically, there are the collapses as of the Maya and the Anasazi and the Easter Islanders, but it's not the case that all societies collapse. There are parts of the world where societies have gone on for thousands of years without any collapse, like Japan and Java, Northwest Europe. And one of the two main reasons why some collapse and some don't is robustness or fragility. Some societies have the misfortune to be living in fragile habitats, like the U.S. southwestern desert, and some have the good fortune to be living in fairly robust habitats. The other variable, of course, is what humans do, and it turns out that it's possible for humans to make a mess even of robust habitats.
Hmm. Yeah, that kind of coincides with both of these reviews, actually. One was in the San Diego Union-Tribune by David Brin. And he said that he kind of argues with, or makes argument against you, stating that you kind of throw out the possibilities of technology. And to quote him, he says, "Skeptical criticism and accountability are pivotal success factors that both Toynbee and Diamond neglect to mention, traits that were lacking in every culture that failed," unquote. And I was curious if whether you'd agree with that.
No, I would disagree, and I would say certainly that I'm right and he's wrong. And the reason I'd say, and in fact I discussed that very point in the last chapter of my book, Collapse, because it's a legitimate issue that thoughtful people bring up and it really needs to be thought about. Namely, will technology solve our problems? And one can see how technology might solve certain problems, targeted technology, if you aim technology at a problem. The reason, though, why technology overall will certainly not be the solution of our problems is that, first of all, we're producing lots of new technologies, and technologies are the major cause of the blow-up of the problems that we've got today. We're inventing not just helpful technologies, but also harmful technologies. And then the second thing is that when you develop a new technology, for example, to solve a problem, regularly the technology has unanticipated side consequences. And the example, because I was growing up in the 1940s, in the 40s, refrigerators used as their coolant gas as poisonous things like ammonia, and you worried going to sleep at night that your refrigerator might develop a leak and you wouldn't wake up dead in the morning. So it was a great advance when those poisonous gases got replaced by a technological breakthrough, the CFCs or freons. And unfortunately, it turned out that under atmospheric conditions that could not have been predicted by experiments on Earth, the freons break down into substances that destroy the ozone layer, and so eventually we have phased out the freons. That's just an example of the unexpected side effects of technology, and that's why I say with confidence I'm right and he's wrong.
Okay. Well, our last quote. This is by Malcolm Gladwell in The New Yorker, January 3rd, and the quote is, "In Collapse, Diamond quite convincingly defends himself against the charge of environmental determinism. His discussions are always nuanced, and he gives political and ideological factors their due. The real issue is how, in coming to terms with the uncertainties and hostilities of the world, the rest of us have turned ourselves into cultural determinists," unquote. Would you agree with that?
Substantially, yes. Yeah, that's well written. I would agree that I'm not an environmental determinist. I don't say that the environment seals your fate, because What happens depends on how you respond to the environment. Example, right here in the United States and the U.S. Southwest, for hundreds of years, Native American peoples made a successful living by farming. At about AD 1200, they came upon the solution of the Pueblo farmers, who were continuing to farm in the Southwest 800 years later. But in many areas of the Southwest today, including the areas where the biggest ruins were left, the Anasazi ruins of Chaco Canyons, European society today, modern American society, hasn't figured out how to farm successfully. So I'm not an environmental determinist. What you do makes a difference. And the other part, the rest of us are cultural determinists. It is true, unfortunately, that especially in the social sciences, many people in the social sciences think that culture is everything, and they don't recognize the basic facts of the environment and soil and water and chemistry, which also have to be taken into consideration. Also, because that review in the New Yorker praised my book, I'm predisposed to like it.
Thumbs up for Mr. Gladwell, then.
Yes.
Let's talk with another listener. I want to thank that caller for his questions this afternoon. Next, we go to Pontiac. Line 4, hi.
Hi, Dr. Diamond. It's just delightful to talk with you. I'm a huge admirer of yours. I have used your book on guns, germs, and steel and talking about the role of assistive technology in the lives of people with disabilities. So I've used it to some pretty different purposes. But anyway, I'm going to be very interested in reading your current book. And my question is about how the it's hard to know how to put this. You know, people not wanting to hear certain kinds of messages and other people actually making their living off of giving people what they want to hear. So I'm thinking of, for example, religious fundamentalist messages that say, you know, it doesn't matter how we treat the earth because, you know, God has this plan and it's all going to blow up anyway, et cetera. Or the messages they get through various kinds of advertisers or corporations. So I'm personally quite pessimistic, and I'm interested in your take on it.
Yeah, those are interesting questions. I can understand why you personally would be pessimistic, and many of my friends are pessimistic, and I'm often asked, Jared, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And my answer is I'm a cautious optimist. I see hopeful signs out there, and one of the perhaps the most hopeful single sign is what you and I are doing now, namely we're connected by the media. We have an opportunity to learn from radio and TV and newspapers and archaeologists. So we can take advantage of the experiments that succeeded or failed in the past, or that are succeeding or failing in distant places, whereas the Anasazi and the Maya didn't have that opportunity. And then the point that you make about closing our eyes, not wanting to learn, and the role of religious fundamentalists is interesting. It happens that one of the largest mining companies in the United States, big problem in the United States is mining companies that have been less forward-looking in their approach to the environment than have the oil companies or the coal miners. Many mining companies just dump their waste onto the environment. And one of the largest mining companies in the United States, it happens that its board of directors consists of members of a religious group that believes that the world is going to come to an end in 10 years. And if that's the case, why worry about this copper and arsenic that we're dumping in the environment? It's not going to make any difference anyway.
I want to thank the listener for her question this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line 2. Good afternoon.
Jared Diamond, it's great to hear you. I have a PhD in ecology and read a lot of your ecology works throughout your 80s, and think it's great that you're applying your ecology knowledge to society. I guess what I want you to do is comment on Brian Check, or Zach, I think his name is, on Fuel for a Runaway Economy Train, something like that in the title, and his concept of that economic growth is the product of per capita growth and per capita consumption, population growth and per capita consumption, and how we can change U.S. and every other country on the planet's desire to always maximize economic growth.
right. The book itself, because I haven't read what he said, I can't comment specifically on his book, but I certainly can comment on the essence of it that you summarized for me, namely economic growth being a product of population growth times per capita consumption. And that, in fact, is one of the key points in the last chapter of my book, where I discuss the fact that many people are understandably preoccupied with problems of population growth. But I mentioned that even more serious than population growth is problems of per capita consumption, because total human impact, total consumption, is the product of population times per capita consumption. And I see a larger threat to a sustainable society coming not from our numbers increasing from 6 billion to 9 billion. Yes, it's bad enough that we can't feed 6 billion people today, and we'll be in more trouble when we can't feed 9 billion. But a bigger problem is the rise in consumption rates as people in the third world try to catch up to the first world. At present, first world consumption rates are in the average about 32 times those in the third world. But there are more people in the third world than in the first world. And if those third world people succeed in catching up, that will greatly increase human impact. Just to take one number, China, if China achieves first world consumption rates, because of the number of Chinese, the product that you referred to, means that human impact on the world, human oil use, will increase by 106% if China achieves first world.
It's a tough trend to reverse.
I'm sorry?
It sounds like a tough trend to reverse, or at least slow down, the fact that third world country per capita consumption is on the increase.
That's right, and it's going to be a particularly tough trend to reverse if the first world insists on maintaining its own consumption rates. In fact, it obviously is not going to fly at all for the United States, Europe, and Japan to say we're going to continue consuming at this high rate, but it's unsustainable for the world as a whole, so you stay down there in your levels of poverty. It's just not going to work.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. At this point, I want to mention there was an interesting article recently in our local newspaper this past Sunday, January 2nd, 2005, about a county panel that was put together a couple of years ago to look at our problems and to begin to pose some possible solutions. And it strikes me that the county has seen maybe, I would say, modest population growth, but we continue to consume more and more. And the article in the newspaper, part of it reads, from land use to water quality, there are reasons to worry about the future, about the consumption of farmland, the toll on a fragile natural environment, and the cost of sustaining the march of suburban cul-de-sacs across open fields. Arresting those patterns will require the mustering of a political will to plan comprehensively and in coordination with a plethora of local governments that have a say in the provision of services. Here at a micro level, we have what you and the last caller were just talking about.
Yeah, and even the words that you choose there are, I would say, right on and paralleled in my book, the expression that you use, political will.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I make the point, and this goes back to the question about the technology as a solution, I make the point that what's missing is not new inventions. What's missing is the political will. We already know enough to deal with our problems. We just have to have the political will to face our problems.
Yeah.
And then the point about at the local level, solving problems at a local level, not just for the world as a whole or the U.S., but at a local level is important because, first of all, if you clean up your local environment, it makes life nicer for you, whatever is happening in the rest of the world. And secondly, the United States is not going to be in a position to urge the people in China or Paraguay how to take care of their environment if the people in China and Paraguay see that we, at the local level and national level, are messing up our own environment.
Yeah. I want to get to a couple more callers here in just a moment. Let me follow up here with just the following paragraph from this article. The good news is that the panel that put the report together represents a cross-section of expertise and interest from rural to urban and from farmers to academics. Further good news, they agreed, if not on all the details, then at least on statements of the problem and the principles needed to resolve them, primarily the principle of sustainability. So we do have some good news here. There is some reason for optimism. We do perhaps have the political will. We have a good political culture in place, and we're taking a look at what we value and what we need to do to protect it.
That's great, because there are many, many places that haven't gotten to that first stage, at least of agreeing on the need for sustainability. There are many, many places, many people that think that we don't need sustainability, but we can go on growing.
Yeah. Let's talk with a couple of listeners now. Next in line, a caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. I wonder, have you considered the propensity of societies under stress to turn to fundamentalism? And by this, I'm thinking particular of the emphasis on formal aspects, putting the Ten Commandments on the courthouse wall, prayer in schools, various other very formal characteristics. And also a claim that our present deplorable state is the result of having turned away from the ways of the past.
Uh-huh.
And these formal aspects obviously differ with different societies, but in a way they're very much alike, whether it's in Islam, Judaism, or Christianity, or even, I suspect, in other faiths and other societies.
Yeah, two interesting points. Let me take them in reverse order. Your second point about turning away from ways of the past, it cuts both ways. On the one hand, we can learn from the past. And in fact, that's the overall point of this new book, Mind Collapse, is that we can learn from those past societies that collapsed and learn from those that succeeded and avoid repeating their mistakes. But at the same time, the past is not a duplicate of the present. And one of the hardest things for society to do is to shed past ways that worked well in the past but no longer work in the present. American consumerism is a good example. For two centuries, we've been the land of unlimited resources and endless frontiers, and it was true, but now it's no longer true. We must turn away from the ways of the past in that respect. On your first point about what happens with societies under stress and their turning towards fundamentalism, it's an interesting point. If you look at societies under stress, for example, if you look at societies in the modern world where there's been what's called state collapse, violent overthrow of a government, civil war, etc., and you ask, what stress indicators predict a civil war or a violent revolution? It's interesting. The two best predictors are high infant mortality and rapid population growth. And that makes the point that these fundamental variables of children dying, so you have to have more children in order to end up with enough children to support you in your old age, these public health indicators, if your kids are dying, then you get desperate and you turn towards fundamentalism, or more seriously today, you turn towards terrorists. You're plenty of crazy. Even in the United States, we've had our crazy terrorists like Timothy McVeigh and Theodore Kaczynski, but Americans don't support those crazy people. But in desperate lands, terrorists do get supported because people don't see any other option.
It seems to me that in fundamentalism, it's a selective choice of what they see in the past, and it often is aspects that border on the non-real, or how should I put this, not rational, and that often what they see in the past isn't there at all. It's an invention of the present.
That's true. Fundamentalists as well as non-fundamentalists, I mean, all of us are at risk of being selective in how we view the past. Some of us, I would say, work explicitly to try to shed our blinders. One can argue about whether we succeed. But those who don't attempt to shed their blinders at all but put on blinders and want to view the past through those blinders, one knows that that's a blueprint for misunderstanding.
Hmm. Recently, there has been interest in studying the role the struggle for natural resources plays in conflict. And some people have suggested ancient hatreds are a cover for the root cause of conflict. And you write about Rwanda in this book. And here's how you put it. Climate change is the dynamite, ethnic violence the fuse. You want to talk with us a little bit about that? I think that might be an appropriate follow-up to our listeners' concern.
Absolutely. This, again, suggests two points. And at this point, I think your listeners are going to go away from this conversation saying, whatever anybody says, Jared Diamond will say it suggests two points, but it really does suggest two points. One of them has to do with Rwanda. All right, the point about Rwanda. Rwanda had an awful genocide in 1994 in which 1 million Rwandans got killed by 6 million other Rwandans. And it's usually portrayed as Hutus killing Tutsis, minority group in Rwanda. The trouble is that even in areas where there weren't any Tutsis to kill, there were still mass killings of Hutus killing Hutus. And it turns out that the background to this was that Rwanda was and still is the most densely populated country in Africa. Population was growing, family size varied between 6 and 8 children. There was massive deforestation, soil erosion, and farms were getting smaller and smaller. Half of all Rwandans had food intakes of less than 1,600 calories per day, which means by definition in the United States that they were malnourished and starving. And it was this dynamite keg that politicians, cynical politicians, exploited in order to stay in power by inciting Hutus against Tutsis. That's the story for Rwanda. And now I've gotten so intensely wrapped up in that awful story in Rwanda that I've forgotten what was the first point that I wanted to make for you.
Well, you know what? A point that comes to my mind is that, you know, with the suggestion that ancient hatreds are at the root of a conflict like the genocide in Rwanda, they allow us to say that those ancient hatreds, using that as a reason, they allow us to say at some level, well, what can we do about that?
That's, in fact, something said almost explicitly by some Rwandans. And that surprised me and it chilled me. I'm accustomed to thinking of population problems as a background factor, but people usually don't refer to them explicitly. And yet, in the explosion in Rwanda, there were Rwandans saying, this country is overpopulated, and it's necessary to kill some people in order to make more resources available. Or another saying, it was in fact the sentence that concluded my chapter on Rwanda in this new book, Collapse. It was what an unfortunate Tutsi, a Tutsi teacher, who happened to be away from the house when the killers came and killed his wife and 4 of his 5 children. And he was asked his take on these awful events. And he said, what's happened is that the people whose children had shoes with which to go to school were killed by the people whose children went to school without shoes. That's to say, in Rwanda, it was poorer people killing less poor people. The explosion was a chance to settle scores.
Hmm. We have to wrap up now. Before we go, though, give us a couple of ideas about what we can do as individuals. We've talked quite a bit about awareness. That's one thing. What else can we do?
Right. Yeah, thank you. It's important to come back to what can we do as individuals, because it's easy to feel powerless and to say, what on earth can we do when these big governments and these big international corporations have a free run? They don't have a free run. There are lots of things we can do. Simple thing to do is vote. For example, the governor of Washington is going to be elected by either 8 votes or 42 votes. So if you and 9 of your friends, you and talk to 9 of your friends, you could have reversed the direction of the vote in Washington. And with elections nowadays, frequently the candidates have different views about the environment, so you really can make a difference. That's one thing. Second thing you can do is buy selectively. There are some companies with very progressive environmental practices, Patagonia, the clothing manufacturer, is one of the leaders. Lowe's and Home Depot and Chevron, the oil company, all have environmental practices that can be admired. So buy from the companies whose environmental practices you like, and boycott or don't buy from the companies whose practices you don't like. That really catches the attention of big businesses. And then a third thing you can do is to give money selectively. If you think, what on earth can my donation of $100 to World Wildlife Fund or Ducks Unlimited, what difference can it make? The problem's much bigger than $100. Remember that many of these environmental organizations, they're highly leveraged. If you give them $100, they get matching funds and they end up with $700. And, for example, it costs about $300 to outfit a park ranger in the Congo with global positioning systems equipment so that he or she can go out and survey some endangered primates. So even small donations of $100 can make a difference. In short, if you care, vote, talk to your friends, buy selectively, and give your money selectively.
Professor Diamond, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
You are welcome. It has been a pleasure once again to be with you.
Jared Diamond has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel. His new book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. The book now available in bookstores, libraries. The book is published by Viking.